Welcome. I'm Jessica Teigen, and this is the Evolving to Exceptional podcast, where we talk about reaching peak performance in our workplaces, homes, and communities so that we can live our best life possible, an exceptional life. Welcome back to this week's episode of the Evolving to Exceptional podcast. This week, we have Jamie Koepke with us here today. She is a very experienced HR and human resources and people leader, has been in a variety of different roles throughout her career and taken a really interesting, I think, career path. And she is here to share with us some of her experiences, some of her insights, especially around the challenges in the workplace and creating that really excellent employee experience. So Jamie, would you be willing to give us just a little bit of introduction as to your background and who you are and why it is you do what you do?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me, Jessica. I appreciate it. Happy to come on today and tell you a little bit about myself, where I come from. I'm currently the VP of People and Culture at Assertus. We're a transportation and logistics company. Really happy to be here. I've been here just over 2.5 years. It's been an interesting journey here in 2.5 years. I've come a long way. My career started in HR in 2009. So right in the midst of all of the economic downturn. And it was interesting. I was never supposed to be in HR. I was supposed to be an accountant. But here I am. I love working with people. I feel very strongly about having a very strong people culture in any organization that I'm working in. And I've come from some really great organizations. I started my career at an engineering firm in Clayton, Missouri. I moved on to a public accounting firm, working in their HR team, back to a professional services company, and then landed here at a transportation and logistics company. So I've had a vast experience in different industries, and my career trajectory has just been amazing. I've learned a lot along the way, and I'm still learning. And that's what gets me out of bed every single morning is the challenges that we face in HR. I think everyone can empathize with that. But that's what gets me up every day. It's the challenges, it's the continued learning, and it's the ability to just really have an impact on people because people matter.
I absolutely love that. And one of the things that had me reach out to you or connect with you was one of your LinkedIn posts talking about kind of the three things that most challenges in life, either in the workplace or just in life in general, stem from. And they were lack of communication, unclear expectations, or a lack of recognition and gratitude. I would just love to start there and talk a little bit about how you've seen those create challenges and why you think they're so important.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that. Jessica, you and I have talked a little bit about, I have been heavily influenced by Brené Brown's work. And so clear is kind is something that resonates with me. But honestly, any conversation that I've had at work regarding just friction, teams not getting along with each other, departments not being able to work well together or collaborate together, always stem from one of those three things or all of those three things. It is always, we didn't communicate clear enough. We didn't set clear enough expectations, or we didn't thank you for your contribution to what you're doing. We didn't recognize that maybe what you did took some extra effort, or what you did really helped us move the needle on some certain initiative. I remember, I don't know, a few years back in my career, I created a conflict resolution training course because we had these two teams that just could not figure it out, And that was one of my very first really experiences with adults not being able to figure out how to get along. And it's just amazing because you think we're adults, we've got this all figured out, we know exactly what we're doing. And that's just not the case, right? We're all human and we all think that we understand things that we don't necessarily. So I remember going through this conflict resolution training and just, it was a great experience. But at the end of it, really, as adults, I had them commit to certain things. Like, what are you going to do leaving this room today to have a positive impact on further collaboration, right? And making people commit to that was so important. And that's what we have to do in our daily lives. I know I have a family. I think most people have family members or friends, right? And so this translates to those relationships as well. It's not just in the workplace, it's in our lives too. If you think about any time you've ever had any conflict with anyone in your life, it comes down to likely one of those three things.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I used to always say, when it comes to employee issues, when it comes to when a manager comes with an employee issue, I always used to say, this is similar, but I used to say it's either expectations or accountability. Most issues can be traced back to one of those two things. If there's a lack of accountability or there were unclear expectations, both of which require good communication, because without it, it breaks down. And I love that you added like the recognition and gratitude component. When it comes to expectations, the thing that I think is so interesting, and when I would train on it, I would talk about all the time that we always think that we're clearer than we actually are. And I would challenge managers to have their employee write up what they think their expectations are and then have the manager do it and see how close they were the same. Because inevitably, in almost every situation, they were misaligned in almost every single instance. And even as I got better at setting expectations, as I worked on that skill set actively, it's still something that you have to constantly practice, or you tend to stray apart. The expectations, you think differently, you respond differently. And what I've discovered since then is that when there aren't those, is the brain-based background, is that when there aren't those clear expectations, our brains actually don't operate as well. So we don't perform as well, because our brains are in this state of insecurity, of being unsure of if this is the right thing or not. And that's using excess energy that could be applied to moving forward in a way that is clear versus being unsure of how we're doing. And I think that kind of applies to the recognition and gratitude too. When we're not sure how we're performing or how we're doing in terms of our performance or getting that appreciation for what we're doing, then that creates this kind of underlying sense of anxiety or insecurity that, whether we're conscious of it or not, is impacting us. Have you seen that? Has that been your experience too, in when it comes to that recognition and gratitude?
100%. I know personally, right? I like to receive any amount of feedback, even if it's just recognizing that I've done something, or, hey, this was great, but, right, you could have done this a little differently. It's hard, I think, at the level that I'm at today. I don't get a lot of feedback from anyone, which is really challenging. So I'm left second guessing a lot of the time if I'm doing things the right way, or if I'm doing things the way that my CEO wants me to do things. I don't know. I don't get a ton of that feedback. And he's busy, right? And everyone's busy. So one of the ways that I am sure that I give my team plenty of feedback is I set a reminder in my calendar every Friday to do shout outs. So that's something we do here at Assertus. We have a company-wide instant messaging tool that we use. We call it Glip. That's not really the name for it, but that's what we call it. And so every Friday, it's Shout Out Friday. So I'm very intentional about setting that reminder. And I make notes throughout the week what I need to be shouting out. So it's a very intentional practice. And I think if more people got into that intentional practice, it would go a long way with their teams and even their family members and their friends.
Yeah. And if you look at Gallup's research on this, is there's significant studies around and it's talked a lot about in terms of positive psychology, right? That you've got to have 6 positives to every 1 negative to counterbalance the negatives. And so what I used to tell my managers is it may feel like overpraising, but what you're really doing, and from a neuroscience-based perspective, what you're really doing is you're giving people hits of dopamine for doing the right thing. And if people are getting that, if they're getting that chemical release, they're going to keep doing the right thing. They're going to keep doing the thing that you're recognizing or giving gratitude for. When you don't do it, there's no dopamine. There's no chemical response saying, keep doing this thing. And so if they get that response from something else, they might be more likely to do that other thing. And so it's actually more important to be giving that praise, that recognition, and doing that for getting performance results, then I think people realize when you don't consider that there's an actual impact happening within people.
That's right. It's the positive reinforcement, right? We all respond to that positive reinforcement.
And I think you made a good point too about when, as you get to different levels with the, or in the organization, the amount of feedback that you get. And interestingly, I was just working on an article this morning around, I stumbled upon some of the statistics around ethical behavior in leadership and self-awareness in leadership. And interestingly, while 95% of people in general think that they're self-aware, only 10 to 15% actually are self-aware. And it's worse for leaders. Only 5% of leaders are actually self-aware. And the lack of perspective, the lack of people that, and getting that perspective and having that alternative feedback can really, I think, lead to some of that lack of self-awareness, that lack of understanding. And so it really takes, I think, intention on the part of leaders to seek out and make the culture safe for leaders to get that feedback. Because if that culture isn't conducive or safe for people to give the feedback, it's going to be really hard for people to do it. Even if a one leader is a great leader and there's not a fear for that leader, it could be just the environment. Have you ever experienced anything like that?
Oh, 100%. I think it's interesting. I hadn't really given it much thought, the lack of self-awareness and not really getting the feedback, but that makes a ton of sense. I definitely have seen that in my career. And I will tell you, just personally, having to give difficult feedback to the C-suite is incredibly hard to do. It is probably one of my least favorite things that I do in my role, right? Today, yesterday, anytime in my career, that's the hardest thing. And there is a lot of fear built into that because you don't know how those leaders are going to react. And I can remember in my past life, a leader saying, once you get to this level, you don't really need any feedback because you've made it. And it just, that hurt my heart. It made me cringe. I was like, every single person needs to understand that they can be better. They can do better. They're not, no one is perfect. And so I think I've made it my personal mission since hearing that. No, you need to understand that at all levels, there is still development. You haven't reached your peak. I think I heard that in one of your first podcasts, Jessica, is about you reach the top of your mountain, but there's always another one, right? And so I think sometimes when you get to a certain level, you may forget that.
Yes. And that reminds me. So I was just finishing up the course that we're going to release around self-awareness. And when you think about your performance mountain, so if you're, everybody's got a mountain, everybody's got a role that they're climbing, that they're performing. And the difference between other skill sets that we develop, that once we have it, as long as we've cultivated, you don't lose it. So if you become a great presenter or speaker, just because you're going through a divorce or your family member passes away or you lose your job, you don't lose your presentation skills, right? Those don't go away. But self-awareness is different in that it's really our guide in our journey. It's there to help us have a better experience and help others to have a better experience. And so it does get impacted. It gets impacted when there's challenges in our journey, when, if you use the mountain analogy, when a boulder falls in your path or the river floods and you can't go the way you thought you were going to be able to go, those divorces or illnesses or having kids or those things that come up in our lives are the triggers that can send us into that lack of self-awareness. And what's interesting about leaders is that when you get that power, so the more power that you get, your brain chemistry changes. And so it actually can be equated to having like a severe brain trauma because of the chemical change in your brain. And so it's not necessarily that leaders are intentionally getting to that point and being like, oh, I don't actually need anything anymore. It's quite literally that their brain chemistry is telling them that they don't need anything anymore. So it takes intention to say, okay, no, that message isn't true. Just because I'm at this point does not mean I stop growing and evolving. I'm a human being, which means I always need to be growing and evolving. And there's always more skill sets. And because our world's constantly changing, I need to be constantly paying attention and evolving within it. And I think it's actually a huge red flag if a leader is not actively cultivating themselves, growing themselves, changing, improving, recognizing new ways to do things. And the more unwilling they are to listen to alternative perspectives, and the more that they rely on their own sense of finding the answers, the worse that is, or the worse the outcome is.
Yeah, I 100% agree with that. We all have growth. And as soon as you're not learning anymore, that's a scary place to be.
And you're absolutely right around the courage to speak upwards, to speak up to the most senior executives. And I think that gets harder the lower you get within an organization. So the further away you are from the CEO, my CEOs would always tell me in the past, like, how come people don't just come and tell me? Why wouldn't they just come tell me if that's going wrong? And people don't. As soon as you're there, they're not going to tell you anymore.
They're too afraid. I think we even see that sadly in our employee opinion surveys too. We see people not wanting to be completely honest in feedback because they do fear that can come back to haunt them, that they'll be terminated, that it will have some negative impact on their career path, which is really sad that people feel that way. But I have found myself in a similar place in my past. So,
and the fear is not unfounded because it's typically part of that. Somewhere it's part of that employee experience, which is why, and we talked about this, why providing that employee experience is so important. And I know you think that too. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about how that's so important. And it's interesting because you have that financial background, like you thought you were going to be an accountant. And sometimes that's where some of the biggest friction, I think, comes within an organization is between the business outcome or the financial value or in investing in that employee experience versus investing in more computers or product or whatever the competing priority is. What has your experience been in that arena?
Yeah. So it's really hard to get investment in people in organizations. It doesn't matter the organization, right? Because what business leaders see is they see the bottom line. And that's what they care about is the bottom line. And we all should, right? That's why we're in business. We're there to make money. But we're also entrusted with the lives of our people. And there is tons of research for yourself. I'm a huge fan of Josh Burson. He does a ton of research on this as well. And there are some really great stats out there related to the employee experience and the outcome on customer experience, which ultimately leads to better business outcomes, right? So what we have to do as organizations is really understand that we need to be focusing at the front end with our people, the people that are actually in there doing the work every single day, the people that are committed to the organization that care, right? That's where we start. That's where we need to make our investment in time, money, and resources because it pays out in dividends on the end in that customer experience and business outcomes. I think Josh Burson's most recent research stated like it's a great customer or great employee experience leads to 2.2 times as much in business outcome, financial outcome, as companies who don't focus on that. That can be huge for companies. That's what we should be focused on. And I say it all the time and I'll tell them till I'm blue in the face, but you got to make that investment on the front end or you continue to churn and burn it on the back end.
Absolutely. And that was our experience too. And interestingly, when I started out, I love Josh Burnson and we used Gallup and Gallup's engagement metrics. And it was so interesting over the years. I think we did it for 7 or 8 years. And over those years, you could literally trend the engagement score with the financials. So if the engagement score was going up, the financials were going up. If the engagement score was going down, the financials were going down. And so you could really tell the impact that as we drove engagement scores up. And once we ultimately were recognized as a Gallup exceptional workplace globally, we got to that point. In order to get that, you have to show actual metrics. You have to be able to prove the impact, the financial impact. And we were able to show almost a 25% increase in profitability over the course of 3 years as our engagement scores drove up. And I think it's interesting because there is such an abundance of data that points to that outcome. And I wonder if, and I'm curious of your thoughts on the challenge potentially for leaders or for those making the decision on where to invest in knowing what the right activities are that ultimately create that outcome, that will really drive those engagement scores, and a hesitation to invest because they aren't sure exactly which thing is going to create that outcome.
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And the challenge we have in HR is that today, more than ever, we have access to a ton of data, more data than we've ever had access to. And it can be overwhelming. And I think it's difficult for HR leaders, for business leaders, for really anyone to understand, okay, we have all this data, what do we do with it? And so a lot of times too, your HR practitioners, they don't have a ton of data analysis background, right? And so it's now I'm recognizing this as I build out my functional org chart. And I'm like, I have this need for someone who can be both, can focus on HR strategies and initiatives, but also understand the data analytics side, because that's where we have a gap with our HR practitioners. That's not how we've been classically trained in HR. We focus on people. We don't look so much at the numbers. But I think to be successful in today's world, right, we have to upskill to mine that data and to be able to tell the story and align it with business outcomes. So that's something I have been working on. I know I just most recently have been working on a little more than a month-long strategic initiative with one of our business units. And it was us really diving in and saying, okay, we want to attack these things. And we think these are the five key strategies that are going to give us the outcome we want, because we're trying to reduce attrition and we're trying to increase retention and want people to come work for us, right? We want that. So it's looking at all these different levers and we're just going to start pulling them and see what kind of outcome we get. What we're hoping is that we start to see our retention numbers increase. And then we also expect to see our productivity increase as it relates to that, which then hits our bottom line. And I think we calculated and this is very conservative, right? When I tell you this, you're going to know it sounds conservative, but it's $12,000 to replace an employee. And that was based on, we were able to monetize that, right? So now we know, based on the recruiting and hiring and training and all the things that go into hiring a person, it's roughly $12,000 per employee. So if we can decrease our attrition, we can cut that cost out.
And that cost, clearly, yeah, it's conservative because it's really only taking into consideration hard costs, right? The like actual financial additional investment, not necessarily the lost manager productivity, the lost other employee productivity when they're having to pick up the load of the other employees. There are long-term health costs for other employees who have to pick up the load when you don't have the person in the role that you need to have them in. There's all these other ancillary costs that aren't those hard costs, but yes, absolutely. And you know what I think is interesting? There was an article done, I can't remember, I think it was Harvard Business Review, about the financial accounting. And that when we look at financial accounting, that people are not considered an asset on the balance sheet. They're considered a liability. They're considered an expense. So when you look at, and I don't know if most employees necessarily know or understand that, but when you look at your corporate financials, if you make an investment in, say, computers, you get to depreciate that value. If you make an investment in a business system, for example, or a major capital investment in terms of a building, that's looked at as a long-term investment. Whereas when you invest in training or development or other elements of the employee experience, that's looked at as an expense. And so even though almost every organization will say our people are our greatest asset, they're so important to us, when it comes down to it, and when you get into the financials, that's not really how they're being looked at. And that has a huge cost. So it takes some creativity and courage, I think, of leaders to say, okay, I'm going to make this investment because I know in 2 to 3 years, it's going to pay off. It's not probably going to pay off in 2 to 3 months. Because it takes time to develop, train, create that experience, and have those longer term payoffs. It's not immediate, and be willing to do that for the long term gain, for what it can do and mean for your organization in the long term.
No, that's exactly right. And that's the challenge that I'm faced with every single day. And it's one that I aim to change, because unfortunately, to your point, Jessica, our people they're not looked at as assets. What is the first thing that most companies do when they need to cut cost? Really, the answer is you need to make more money. But the flip side of that is cutting cost. If you're not able to make more money because for whatever reason, you got to cut costs. So what's the first thing that typically goes? And that's unfortunate. And that's one of the other things that I don't love about working in HR, right? Because unfortunately, we are the face of those decisions a lot of times. Even if we aren't the decision makers, we're definitely the face of those decisions.
Yeah, absolutely. And you see it all the time. You see how organizations swing, and swings are normal. There's ups and there's downs in business. Business comes, it goes, gets better. You have tougher times, worse times. And what you end up seeing, and what I think is a consequence of that, I'm curious of your thoughts on this, is that organizations begin to rely upon those opportunities to clear out the poor performers or those that aren't contributing the way that they should be contributing or managing performance effectively. Managers aren't managing performance effectively. And so organizations use that as an opportunity to cut those that aren't performing, and they become reliant on that rather than actually get a fully performing organization that might not have those consequences, that might not see the same financial dip, that might be able to maintain more people or have more profit. Instead, they get complicit and comfortable in that they're just going to have to do reductions every couple of years, or that's just part of what they do. They hire a lot when they need them, and then everybody who doesn't work out, they just get rid of them rather than really effectively manage them. Have you seen that?
I see it all the time. I've seen it in multiple of my roles at multiple companies. It's a sad way to manage people, right? Because what I call it is warm body syndrome. So much to your point, they get comfortable, they get complacent. I just need someone sitting in the seat doing the job, no matter how effective or ineffective they're being. I just need a warm body. And instead of having those courageous conversations with people, giving them the appropriate feedback, recognizing them when they need to be recognized, doing the things that you're supposed to do as a manager. In fact, I just coined this phrase this week. I said, manager up. That's what you have to do. You have to manager up. There are these hard conversations that you need to have, and they don't have to be hard. Regularly give the feedback so that people can develop. Coach them up, or you have to coach them out. Don't wait for these yearly events or every few year events where you know you're just going to have to cut 10% of people, whatever the number is. I made that up. But don't let that be the solution to your problem, because your productivity will always fail at that point. You're never getting to the point where you need to get to as an organization if that's your solution.
Yeah. And in that scenario, it's hard to have those conversations or to manager up. I love that term. Yep. Because it's not something you have done enough to get comfortable with it. Yeah. And so it takes practice. It takes creating those neural pathways in your brain so that you can get good at it, and you can get good at doing it. You can actually get good at doing it in a way that is not detrimental or as difficult as it is when you're unskilled. Once you get skilled at doing it frequently enough, it's not some foreboding, terrible conflict, friction-based experience. It's just a conversation between two people who trust each other saying, hey, that wasn't good enough. We got to do better. How are we going to do better? And it doesn't feel or have the same intensity that it does when we're not skilled. One of the things I think that's interesting is that a lot of the stuff when it comes to the employee experience is often viewed as soft or nice to have, or it'd be great if we could, or when we have excess money, we'll consider approach. And in my experience, I think finances and some of those other things are really black and white, which makes it much easier to make a decision. And what's interesting is that there's this shift happening in that we really do have scientific data today. And with the combination of research, with technology, with advancements, that tells us exactly what the consequences of and the benefits are of different quote unquote soft skills of different things like setting expectations that we talked about at the beginning. And you can actually measure the difference in productivity of someone who is in a calm alert state than someone who is operating in a toxic or unsafe organization and how that impacts productivity. And there's metrics for all of those things today that maybe we didn't have in the past, where training was just like a nice to have, feel good kind of thing, or wellness programs are just a, wouldn't it be great if people were, that sounds nice, versus no, this equates to actual dollars and cents every single day because of the impact it's having on the brains and bodies of the people that you're having do the work in your organization. And I'm not sure that although that science and research and information exists, I'm not sure it's all being translated to the leaders and organizations, that they are really absorbing that this is no longer what it was 10 years ago, that it's completely different. And even in the last 2 to 3 years, the research and the data and the metrics and the things that you and I are looking at exist. Do you think that is the case, or have you found that to be the case, that there's just a lack of awareness?
100%. And I think a lot of our leaders today, they grew up in a time where we didn't have those things. You come to work, you do your job, and you go home. And that was the culture. You didn't need to feel that sense of purpose 10 years ago. But to your point, even in the last 2 years, things have changed. The entire landscape looks different today than it did in 2019. And I think there is a lack of awareness. I think there's also a lack of, we don't know what to do with it. Because we've been in this mindset for so long that these are the things that are important. How do we shift the hearts and minds of today's leaders to understand, like, it is different? Like, we can't do what we did 2 and 3 years ago, 10 years ago, and expect the same results or something more today than what we would have gotten 10 years ago. So we have to figure that. We have to figure out what that looks like for leaders.
And it seems like we're seeing the effects of not doing that. I think Gallup just released a report in the last week, maybe it's a little bit older, but saying that now the percentage of quiet quitters is up to 60%. 60% of the workforce is quiet quitting. It was 50% like a couple months ago, the last I checked. So it's now up to 60%. And that's a huge flag saying that something has changed. And I would argue that it's people's mindsets, but it's also that their neurobiology changed through the pandemic, that the experiences that we had forever shaped our brains and how we think and see the world. And that we have to take that into consideration in terms of our workplaces and how we're running and managing them. And the organizations that do, what I do know is that the organizations that do that are going to see tremendous benefits and gains from it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And I think you're exactly right. I think people's priorities changed throughout the pandemic. They really reanalyzed their lives and thought, this just isn't as important to me. I need something more. I need to be more fulfilled, whatever it is. And I would say, you mentioned the quiet quitting, Jessica. What we're noticing a lot is people just not starting. They accept an offer and then they don't start on day one. And I have never in my career seen so much of that, or not showing up for interviews, or just, I don't know why that's happening, but I know it's happening with much more frequency than it ever has in my career.
Yeah, it's definitely, I don't think there's anyone that doesn't recognize that the landscape has changed. The real question is whether leaders will engage in a way that changes things, that makes it different. And it'll be really interesting to see the results of that. And it's not like a future thing. Everybody used to talk about the future of work. That was like 3 to 5 years ago before the pandemic. There was all this writing about the future of work. And what's interesting is how quickly that became right now, and how things are just shifting right now so quickly that leaders have a lot of work to do to stay relevant and to really have the skills necessary for great leadership. And that's going to take, I think, some investment.
100% it will. And I think, interestingly enough, I have these sayings and I have post-its all over my computer screens here. These sayings that I say on a regular basis, but one of my new ones this week is, if nothing changes. And it's so true. If we don't change the way that we engage with our people, if we don't change the way that we are actually doing things, then nothing will change in terms of our business outcomes, except for maybe into the negative.
Yeah. And one of the things I've discovered is that in terms of the US specifically, we're a little bit behind actually in comparison to some other countries in terms of what they're doing in leveraging neuroscience and leveraging the data and research that exists today on human performance. And I was just speaking last night with Sylvia Damianco, I think is how you say her last name, but she created a neuro leadership assessment 10 years ago. And this has this organization that just does tremendous work in the space of developing leaders for the world that exists now today, for the challenges that exist today. And what she really points out is how different of a skill set leaders really need to be successful than what we've been doing with developing leaders for a long time. And so those original practices, those best practices are still best practices. There's just a whole new set of skills that leaders have to be developing to navigate the world that we now exist in. And she works with the security exchange equivalent of in Australia is where she's located, and has talked about how impactful as they've begun to transform their organization, that the impacts that's having on leaders and how positive and how significantly valuable all of that is. And so I think there's a lot to come if we can step into this space and get the benefits of what other countries have already been doing for the last 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I'm definitely going to be one of those HR leaders who's going to continue planting the seeds for that, because I know we have to. It's the future. And we have to do it. We have to find a way.
So one other thing that we talked about was a little bit about the career journey that we take as leaders, but just as women in general throughout our careers and men as well, and that we go through these different stages. And we were chatting about that I'm right now at a stage where my kids are really young. I have twin almost four-year-old. They're four in a week. And a seven-year-old son. And so my kids are still real small, and that has impacted and changed what I'm willing to do, what I'm not willing to do, how far I'm willing to go to speak or do a keynote on stage versus doing things virtually. And you're at a different stage. Your kids are much older. And so now you're really engaging in, okay, how do I really do more in your career? I'm curious a little bit about what you would maybe tell aspiring leaders or female leaders about that journey. What bit of advice might you give those that are gonna walk that path to help them navigate what you've navigated?
Yeah, so really great question. And I think, yeah, you and I talked about this at length, right? Because I started my career in an interesting way. I was a non-traditional student. I ended up having all three of my kids while I was going to college, working full-time. I ended up getting 2 degrees, having 3 kids, all in 7 years' time, and working full time that entire time. So it was an interesting journey. But I'd say early on for me, it was about setting boundaries. It was about knowing my priorities and knowing that it was very important for me to be present and to be able to be at school functions and to not miss the sports. And I set my boundaries, and I was very open and I was very honest with my leaders during that time. This is very important to me. My family is the most important thing to me. And so I slowed down my career growth during those formative years that my kids were young. I now have teenagers. I have one child who's going off to college in a year, and my daughter's just getting into high school. And I have my youngest son is two years left of grade school. So it's like all of a sudden I'm in this whole new world, and I am very focused on my career. Not that I'm not focused on my kids, but they just need less of me. And so now I can focus on my career. And there's a whole lot more that I want out of my career at this point, because at some point my kids are going to grow their wings and they're going to fly. And that's what I want them to do. That's what I've raised them to do. And so I need to, at this point in my career, focus on my needs. And so I would say my advice to any parent or anyone that's going to become a parent at some point in your career journey, just be honest about what's important to you. Be open about your priorities, set those boundaries. And if something isn't working for you, move on. Because your years are the years you have with your kids, it's short.
That is such great advice and valuable feedback, because I think in my background, I thought I could do it all. I thought that I could be I'd already gotten to an executive leadership position. I had kids later in life, and I thought I could manage it. I could be that superwoman. And what I've discovered is I don't think I'm alone in that didn't work, that imploded. And there's this mass exodus of female leaders who've left the workplace, the traditional workplace, and who've really made that decision to set some of those boundaries and to make some changes and some shifts because of how important that is to your life overall, even if it impacts your career in some way. And so I think that advice is just incredibly powerful and such a great reminder for anybody as they're going through this space that it's okay not to be it all and do it all. And it's okay to make decisions about what those boundaries look like for you so that you can be the person that you want to be and achieve what you want to achieve.
That's right. And it's powerful. And honestly, they're my biggest cheerleaders today. So it's amazing. They're happy to see successful, happy mom while they still get their independence. So it's been good for us.
How do you think with that kind of exit of so many female leaders and really females from the workplace, 2 million left during the pandemic, what do you think is required to bring them back to? What do we most need to change in our workplaces? And we've talked a lot about the experience in general, but is there something in particular you think really is important in order to see that population come back?
I think we need to see more women at the top. Quite honestly, that's where we need to see them. I think, Jessica, I think you can probably empathize with this. I'm sure you've experienced this in your career, but I am one woman in our leadership team of all men, right? And so it's really hard to break through that. I have to ask, and we'll probably always have to ask for that seat at the table. That's another piece of advice that I would have for people, though, is to ask. Don't wait for someone to offer it to you. Ask for it. Because it's yours, but you have to ask for it, unfortunately. It's not just going to land at your front doorstep. But I think to get women back, we need to have more people like us sitting in those seats to make us feel like we can get there. We can achieve that. We can do that.
Yeah. So how do we attract them, you think? How do we attract to those most senior roles? Because like you, I was the only female on an executive team for many, many years. And it is a lonely and challenging mm-hmm. role to play. And I actually don't even know the answer. There may not be a clear answer in terms of how we shift workplaces to account for that, to make that shift ultimately and create those culture changes that will attract senior female leaders back into the workplaces.
I think what women need to see, and maybe even not just women today, right? But people in general just need to see that behavior modeled. What does that look like for people? As a working parent, as a working adult, you don't even have to be a parent. People have interests outside of work, right? Where they need that work life. I like to call it work life integration because I think the lines are blurred so much these days. It's not necessarily about balance, but it's how can I integrate all of this together? Where can I do my work? How can I do my work? But seeing that behavior model, like it's okay to take time off. It's okay to completely disconnect. It's okay to not check your email every second of the day. And seeing that behavior modeled, I think, is super important to get women, especially, back into those roles, to see people saying, okay, I'm going to take the afternoon off because it's my kid's field day, and being okay with them doing that. Or, hey, I'm going to Italy for 2 weeks to hike and backpack and do whatever you do in Italy. Never been. But modeling the behaviors that we want to see and letting people know it's okay. It's okay to do that.
I think you're right. And I almost wonder if in order to see it, in order to see those other leaders engage in some of those things, my husband and I used to joke that we needed leaders to go through like a leadership, a shadowing experience. Like, how do you create an empathy building experience for leaders that don't have the perspective, that have never been the parent that has to make it to pick up the kids by 5:30 because that's when school closes. And so when they're saying employees can't leave before 5:30, but you have to pick up your child before 5:30 because literally there is no alternative, how do you navigate that? And the other laundry list of challenges that many leaders don't necessarily or haven't necessarily ever experienced. And so that's one of the things I've always wondered is what would it be like to create shadow experiences where leaders could really gain some perspective on how what the experience really is of people in other life situations or in other dealing with other types of challenges.
I think that shadowing situation could be incredibly impactful for a lot of leaders. I will say this, whenever I've ever had to have a conversation with a manager about a person's schedule, because maybe the only transportation they have allows them to work till 4, or maybe they have children that they have to get picked up from school, or maybe it's a doctor's appointment, or maybe whatever it is, right? The question I always ask managers is, do you care more about seeing a person sitting in their seat, or do you care about the output? What do you care more about? Is it about seeing a person in their seat, or is it about what they're doing and their productivity? And that typically makes them think about their response before answering the question, because I think it should always be about the productivity and the outcome.
Absolutely. And if you're effectively managing performance and the person is performing, then there's little risk in allowing that flexibility to occur. And one of my favorite examples when it comes to shadowing or giving perspective, and this just made me think of it, is so my dad was a senior CEO executive in an engineering organization as a leader. And the first time he ever really was up close with the challenges of pumping and breastfeeding was when I went through it. And I, with my twin girls, they had a food protein intolerance. So my girls literally could not have formula. So when I tried to make my life a little bit easier after months of feeding twin girls tandem around the clock, which comes with its whole own set of sleep deprivation challenges. When I tried to supplement with formula, I discovered I couldn't. And so I actually had to pump and feed them for almost 18 months before I could get them onto a different type of milk. And I remember my dad saying to me, like, I never knew how hard this is and what this takes. Because when you know it, it's different than when you see it. When you see how much effort it takes to put a pump on and to do all the steps and to do the cleaning and to do all the things you have to do, and you see it up close and you see how much time it takes and you see the energy and all the pieces to it, you have a different appreciation for what people are going through. And so I always loved that experience or that example of the power that perspective can bring, and making space for being able to observe and understand those challenges rather than just passing judgment on them, rather than just assuming you know what it must be like and being dismissive or having some other perspective. So, Jamie, I want to wrap this up, but before I do, I want to give you a chance to just give any final thoughts that you might have or things you might want to share with our audience. This has been an excellent conversation with just fantastic topics. So I think we could go on forever, but do you have any final insights or things you'd like to share with the audience?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This has been an awesome conversation. I appreciate this, Jessica, so much. The only thing that I'll leave the audience with is something that was said to me. So whenever I moved into this role as a VP of People and Culture, in my mind, I told myself, you're not ready for this. You're not ready for this. You're not ready for this. I psyched myself out. But I have some great people in my corner who said, you have to do this. You absolutely have to apply for this job. And the piece of advice that was given to me that was hugely impactful, and I'm so glad that I took it, is that 80% of your career is on you. So whatever you want to do, reach for it, grab for it, go for it, because it's ultimately, it's on you. And so if there's something that you want to try, that you want to do, that you're afraid to try, go for it, because no one is going to just hand it to you. So that's, yeah.
Fantastic.
I wouldn't be where I am today if I hadn't done it. So
I love that advice. And I think those that ask for it get further in their career. I think it's a great bit of wisdom for those out there that are maybe aspiring and wondering if they can do it. And the answer is you can. You just have to grow and evolve yourself to do the things you need to do to be successful. And if you're willing to do that, you can accomplish a lot. So thank you to all of our listeners for tuning in today. Thank you, Jamie, for coming on. You were an excellent guest. I think we had a fantastic conversation and diving into all of the aspects of leadership and the employee experience and the challenges that come and the things that are so critical. And hopefully, if you're a leader listening to this, you will take this to heart and consider, how are you evolving, growing, investing in your leadership and in the leaders that work for you and your organization? And I encourage you, no matter who you go to or what program you do, something, work in this space so that you're continuing to cultivate the skill sets that you need to be that excellent leader, to make that difference, and to create that exceptional experience that is going to help your business. As I always end every single episode, just remember to always keep evolving, always keep growing, always keep looking at how you can be better and enjoy more of the experiences on your journey and on your performance mountain. Have a wonderful day, and we'll be back again next week.